Here we have 11589 bleak 2. 11589 bleak 2. Mary Howarth. Mary Howarth. Mary Howarth, 11589 oblique 2. Real 2. Real 2.
Real 2. It would seem that they had quite a lot of spirit, the Finns.
Oh, no, it's unbelievable. They have a word in Finnish called sisu. It means intestinal fortitude. And they have this wonderful, gutsy way of getting hold of things, in spite of the fact that they had lost the war and that they had heavier reparations to pay than any country has ever had to pay. They paid it off, and I think they had given them 10 years, and they paid it off in 4 or 5 years. And they just put their heads down, and they worked like, they're just unbelievable workers. So that the morale was so good up there. And when people came up to visit us from Germany, or places where they had the devastation was so great and nobody knew how to get hold of it, they would say, oh, you're so fortunate here because these people are trying so hard to do what needed to be done. It was wonderful. And they were so appreciative of the fact that we were there.
Is there anything you identify that sort of explains that?
For the Finns?
Spirit? Yes.
Oh, that's a very good question. I've never thought about that. That's a very good question. I have no idea why.
Was the government, you know, particularly their sort of policies?
Well, this doesn't explain it, but this gives some of the historical background of it. Back in the early times of the 19th century, and I can't remember, the 20th century, 1910, 1914, Russia was occupying Finland at that time, and they put something on the Finns that the Finns didn't like. It was just the straw that broke the camel's back. And there was a general strike. All of Finland just said no. The trams stopped running. Nobody delivered the milk. Nobody delivered the post. Everybody just said no. There was just a general strike in the entire country. And I think that the Finns had lived close enough to the Russians for years that the Russians realized that if they went into Finland and occupied in the same way that they did in Czechoslovakia and Poland, that the Finns would just say no. They're very, very stubborn people. And they're very independent. They had a higher literacy rate than anybody else in Europe at that time. And they had given women suffrage before anybody else in Europe had. So there were these historical things that verify that kind of spirit, but they don't explain it. I really can't explain that. It's a Finno-Ugrian language, so they are related to Hungarians. And some of the things that have happened in Hungary, you know, you can see that same kind of sort of stubbornness. We just are not going to let you do that to us. But we were in Finland the first time that the Russians went into Czechoslovakia, and we were there. I was also there in '60s when they came back the second time to Czechoslovakia. And every time there's a feeling in Finland that maybe we'll be next. So they feel very, very close to the Czechs. But I think that the Russians know them well enough to know that if they don't go in, the Finns will do everything they can to try and maintain their freedom and keep independent. And that's better for Russia than it is to take them over and then have to deal with them because they're very difficult. And that doesn't explain it, but it's unique.
Were you sort of given help by the government yourself regarding accommodation and travel, that
yes,
sort of thing?
Right. No, we weren't. We worked with the Finnish Settlement Movement, which was a religious organization within Finland. I don't know what its relationship is to the Lutheran Church, but the Lutheran Church is a state church in Finland. And the people in the settlement movement, I don't know. I mean, it's very hard for me to explain what it was that we had in common with them, but we had this wonderful rapport with the people in the settlement movement and people that had worked, for instance, in the bomb shelters in Helsinki among the homeless men. They were women primarily who had dedicated their lives, really, to doing service kind of work, and it fitted in with what the Quakers were trying to do. And then there were one or two men who were just, Sippy Serenius was just the most remarkable man, and he had founded the settlement movement, and he and Douglas Steere were very close friends. Heikki Vaaris was a professor at the University of Helsinki, and he was very close to us. And the man who was in charge of the Rovaniemi settlement, which is the one up in Lapland, Arvo Ohinen, was also very close to us. So we had these close ties with the Finns that we worked with, and there was a reciprocal thing that I, as I've heard other people talk about relief things, or even in the China situation that you and I were talking about, there wasn't the same equality, and the fact that they knew the situation much better than we did, and they were able to say to us, no, that would be a foolish thing to do. If you do that, the butter will get onto the black market, and don't do that. And they stood up to us in a way that other countries that had been subservient or that had been colonies, the people, we worked in India for 2 years, and it's so hard to get people to take that kind of initiative if they don't have it just naturally. And the Finns had it naturally, which was just one wonderful blessing. It was marvelous. Yeah.
How about your own life there, you know, apart from the work you were doing in the work camps?
Mm-hmm.
What would a sort of typical day have been for you, do you think?
Well, it was very different as it went along. At the very beginning, we were doing primarily relief work, and we were distributing through the schools because they had decided that that would be the best way to help the population as a whole. So, actually, I had a wonderful time because we went out and visited schools. And I love to talk to children and be with children. And so I would sing, for instance, we have a song called Old MacDonald Had a Farm. You have this in England, right? Well, in Finland, each of the animals says a different noise from what we say in the United States. So, for instance, where our pigs say oink, oink, their pigs say nerf, nerf. So I would sing Old MacDonald Had a Farm, and then I would say oink, oink, and ask them to try and guess what the animal was. So I had a wonderful time going around visiting schools. Then the other funny thing was that I went to Middlebury College, which is a wonderful language school, but I never took any language there. But because it was in Vermont, I learned how to ski. And if I hadn't known how to ski in Finland, I would have been no use at all, because there were places that we could get on the train, then there were places that we could get by sled, there were places we could get by truck, but then there were places that we could only get by ski. So I skied into some of these back areas that was the only way to get to. So my good college education paid off because I knew how to ski.
Could you speak the language?
Oh, say something in Finnish. Is that what you mean? Yes. Oh, could I speak the language? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Well, I started to study the Army Finnish before we went to Finland, and we learned how to say things like Mihin aikaan elokuvat alkavat, which means what time does the film begin for the cinema? And, you know, what's the cost of beer? All the things that boys in the Army would have liked to know, those were the things that we knew. There wasn't a cinema anywhere in Lapland, no beer. So, you know, the things that we knew how to say best we weren't able to use. But it was wonderful because it was the first time that I'd ever learned a language in a situation where everybody was speaking that language. And you learn it like a child. And every new word that you learn is a wonderful new experience. And so we learned this expression, Jotain mätä tanska maassa. There's something rotten in the state of Denmark. And every time we'd have a flat tire or anything bad would happen, we'd quote Shakespeare, and they just thought that was wonderful. So people were so appreciative of the fact that we were learning Finnish. And we learned lots and lots of folk songs as we drove. We drove for miles and miles and miles in the truck all through Lapland, delivering the goods and then going to visit the schools and seeing that the clothes were given out. We had local committees that met in each town to decide about the distribution of clothing. And the food was distributed through the schools, so that wasn't a problem. The children that came to the schools, everybody got it.
Could you sort of rely on the people that the clothes would be distributed fairly?
Well, that was what the Finns were with us for. And we had local committees that would have on them people from all of the different political parties and church groups and non-church groups and so forth. So the local committees, and then our Finnish interpreters were the ones that would go and meet with these committees to be sure that everything was being given impartially. And we never had any problem with that.
Did you get an idea, Mary, of the state of the people, you know, their sort of health, the food situation, and the clothing, you know, what they sort of appeared like to you?
Well, that was very bad when we first went up, although most of them had been in Sweden. So they had been outfitted before they came back, and during the war they had had plenty to eat. But food in Lapland was very difficult. They primarily reindeer meat, and we always had potatoes. I don't know where they couldn't have been raising them, so they must have imported them. But the food that we brought in were, we brought in butter and sugar, which was in very short supply, and then staples like corned beef and meat, that kind of thing. And that was what we gave to the schools. And then vitamins. We had somebody in the United States got to one of the vitamin companies and asked them if they would contribute vitamins. And so we gave vitamins out in each of the schools. Each day the children would get a multiple vitamin too, which when it's that dark, it's better. They have they had a lot of rickets. All the things that come from malnutrition were very bad. Tuberculosis is bad because there isn't much sun. But I have one funny story. Can I tell you a funny story? Okay. This Heikki Baris that I told you about, who was the university professor in Helsinki, was a very sophisticated person. He'd been educated at Columbia University in New York and prided himself on his understanding of the American colloquial language and so forth. And so at some point they asked him to take a Red Cross man through Lapland and do his translation for him and show him what the conditions were up there. Now you have to understand that this is in the wintertime when it's sort of like twilight for most of the day, so it's rather dark. Temperatures run 20, 30 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. When they get down to 30 or 40, then it's the same centigrade, so that's pretty cold. And people were living in saunas, as I told you. So they're whizzing through this dark forest and trees on both sides of the road. And suddenly they pass this man walking down the road totally naked. And so the Red Cross man sort of does a second take at that, you see. And Heikki Baris says, yes, that's the clothing situation in Lapland. Doesn't explain about sauna. The fact that, you know, you go into the sauna and then you come out and you're so hot that you can walk through the temperature. So that was Heikki Baris. They're very funny, practical jokers, the Finns. This was something else that was a little hard to get onto. But they think it's funny if they lock you out of the sauna, you see, and the temperature's 30 outside. But one night we had some warm weather and the snow had sort of glazed over. It had melted and then frozen, so it was like ice all over the top of the snow. So they said, now what you have to do is you have to go out and throw yourself into the snowbank. Well, you throw yourself, it's like throwing yourself through a plate glass window. They think that's very funny. So they have a strange sense of humor. But after a while, we got onto it.
When was it you met your husband?
Well, we had met before we went abroad, actually. We met in Chicago. And I had gone to Chicago to organize weekend work camps. Before I went abroad, I was looking for a job, and that was one that was available. And so Wilfred had been sent to Chicago to study X-ray repair with General Electric. And he came down to the Friends Service Committee office and said, I'm in Chicago, and I'm staying at the YMCA, and I don't know anybody. Do you have anything going on the weekends? And I said, yes, we're starting weekend work camps. So the first weekend work camp in Chicago was me and Wilfred. Nobody else came. So we got to know each other very quickly. And we saw each other once or twice a week for the next two or three weeks. And then he called one day and said, I have to leave this afternoon for China. I'll be going out on the train at 4:00. Can you come down to the railroad station and say goodbye to me? So off he went. And it's a long story from there, and I hope he didn't tell you the whole thing this afternoon. But it's we managed to make it through 2 years. Somebody, I think it was you, that was talking about women in the unit. For those of us who were in love with men who were in the unit, the women in the unit were something of a problem to us because the men were lonely and they were oftentimes sick. Wilfred had malaria for a period of time, so that their resistance was low. And these beautiful young Florence Nightingale people were floating around, and that was kind of scary for us. So that's a side of it that you may not have gotten from anybody else. And then the other thing that influenced us very strongly was when Wilfred finally did leave China and was able to transfer and come up to Finland to work. He had been impressed by the fact that when couples were married in the unit in China, it became very awkward for the unit, because if they wanted to send a doctor one place and a nurse the other place, and they were married, they would insist on being together, and that made it very difficult for the unit. So when Wilfred arrived in Finland, he was determined that we were not going to cause those kinds of problems for the American Friends Service Committee. And I was somewhat more romantic than he was, and I thought we could manage that sort of thing. And actually, we did. We were married, but we also were separated during periods of time. There were times when I was working up in Lapland and he was down in southern Finland, and times when I had to go off on recruiting trips to Norway and Denmark and Sweden, and he would be stuck in Helsinki or someplace else.
But was there a great difference between the north and the south in Finland, you know, regarding
That's
the
right.
devastation?
That's right, there was. The Germans had done this scorched earth policy, just primarily in Lapland. And the southern part of Finland had been bombed. Helsinki had been bombed during the war, and Karelia had been taken over by the Russians, and the Karelians were refugees in Finland. So in southern Finland, they had refugee camps and resettlement problems, but in the north, there was primarily the devastation to deal with. So it was quite different. And the places where the reindeer wandered had been land mines had been put all through the forest, so that children that were out berry picking would step on these mines and reindeer would step on the mines. So that was the situation in the north, and that was quite different from the south, yes.
Was there enough medical attention there?
In the north?
Think? Yes. Sort of, you know,
That's
your work camp.
We
did
had
you get the feeling that people were being cared for medically?
That's a hard one. I don't know really about that. There was a hospital in Rovaniemi, and also maybe one in Kemijärvi. And there were places where helicopters could come in and pick people up. So, for instance, in one of the camps, one of the soldiers, they had found a landmine, and the soldier, in order to detonate it, had thrown it into the lake. And when it hit the lake, it exploded, and the soldier was caught in the hip with this piece of shrapnel. And I happened to be in that camp when this happened. So we put him in the back of the car, and we had nurses in each one of the camps. And the nurse from the camp drove with us, and we drove him to the nearest place where he could be picked up by airplane and taken into the hospital in Rovaniemi. So that's the only example that I can think of specifically. I don't even know what kind of health service there were in the little villages. I doubt if there was any at all. Hardly any doctors that I can remember. Yeah.
Did you stay right to the end? You know, all the time the camps were under American sort of supervision.
Yes, we were there for 2 years, and that's the length of time that they were. I think probably 6 months before we left, the Finns had taken them over. And there was a very good international work camp movement in Europe at that time. So we had gone to work camp conferences in Denmark. We went to one there. And in Germany, and different representatives from our group would go out to these other places where people from Germany and France and other countries where they had work camps would meet. And then we did things like talk about what the difference were in the different camps. We made up a song book that everybody could use that had songs from each of the countries and those kinds of things that we did. Mm-hmm. But by the time we left, the Finns were running the entire organization. We didn't have anything more to do with it.
Did you like Finland, you know, the sort of landscape?
We just loved it. It was so beautiful. And those lakes, in the summertime particularly, it was like living on a movie set, a colored movie set. Technicolor had just come in, so that it was so wonderful to see movies that were in color. And that's the way it felt in Finland in the summertime. It was so beautiful. There were mosquitoes there to keep you from getting totally romantic about the situation. And one day I was down collecting lumber with another young woman, and we were walking back and forth waiting for him to load the truck. And I put my hand up and slapped her back where the mosquitoes were gathered. And I had 20 mosquitoes on my hand. So the mosquitoes were something to deal with. But now that I think back on it from this age, I don't remember the mosquitoes. I just remember the beauty. It was so lovely.
Did the Finns know you were pacifists?
Yes, they did. And we had many, many talks about that kind of thing, you know, theoretically, whether or not it would work, you know, how in their situation it might have worked. And the fact that they had had this general strike meant that they really had done civil disobedience at that time. And everybody was interested in what was happening in India with Gandhi, which was a very lively thing at that point, you see, and whether or not that would work. Most people knew about Tolstoy. So there were places where this had entered in. But Finland as a whole is a very militaristic, unpacifistic country. And I think that they would say that the reason that they're independent now is because they had been like that. And that would be a hard thing for us to try and refute. I think that's probably true.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Does it teach you anything about pacifism? And, you know, the sort of context of it, that perhaps it's easier to be a pacifist in some countries rather than others.
Oh, yes. I think that's absolutely true. I'm glad you mentioned the word context, because I think this morning when you were speaking, I was thinking so much about the fact that I think women make ethical decisions within certain contexts. And the fact that you said that in the FAU, they were making ethical decisions within certain contexts. To me, that was a thing about the FAU that was a very feminine kind of a thing. That's very different from, say, the hierarchy in the army or in law, where you have to do things according to legal tradition and so forth. That in the FAU, they were able to look at the entire context and make a decision that maybe wasn't absolutely clear-cut and something that you could come right down to the line and say, this is the truth, but that it was the best that they could do in that particular situation. And I think with the Finns, you know, it was not an issue, the fact that we were pacifists and they had been very military. We knew that there were people that had been in, well, all the people that we worked with had either been in the army or they had had a women's service called the Martas. And most of the women who were leaders in our work camps were women that had been leaders in the military camps for women, like the WAF, or whatever the units were, WASPs. I can't remember what our units were, and it's too far back. But we had many, many discussions about those kinds of things. We talked a lot about that kind of thing.
Did you find your experience in Finland, did it reinforce your pacifism, or, you know, did you change in any way, one way or the other?
That's a good question.
Were you as sort of convinced?
Oh, yes, I think I was. I think somebody was saying today that they thought as we got older, we realized more and more that everything is a compromise. And I think that that's probably true. I think when you're young, you see things in blacks and whites. And then you begin to see grays and mauves and all these other variations in between. I don't think it changed what I felt was the best thing to do in a situation. But I think I became much more aware of the fact that other people's situations are different from my situation, and that it isn't possible for me from this point to judge another person. I mean, the Finns were so totally different. Their experience had been so totally different from those of us that were in the United States. And we really loved them a lot, and we felt that they had done what was right for them in that situation. And who were we to say that it wasn't right? It was right for them. So I think if anything changed, that was it. I think I got a little more compassionate, probably. I hope I did.
Yes, how do you feel today? You know, for instance, with the Gulf crisis and the stance your country has and
right,
has taken.
Right.
You know, do you...
I feel very clear about the fact that that was just an absolutely crazy thing to do. And we were talking with somebody today whose daughter works at the comment desk in the White House. And we got that number and we called up. And every place that we've gone here in Britain, I hear the things on the telly that says, you know, the people are so totally beyond George Bush, behind George Bush. And I tell all of our relatives here, I don't know anybody that's behind George Bush. So it just depends upon who the people are that you hear. And apparently the media hears only the people that are behind George Bush. I just can't believe that. I think that we're caught in a terrible trap of consumerism and materialism. And a lot of my perspective on that comes from having spent 2 years in India, which is a totally different situation again from Finland. But instead of conserving and trying to do things to save oil or to cut down on our use of oil, here's George Bush driving around in his golf cart or flying back and forth from Washington, D.C. on a jet plane. And where he could take some leadership and where he could do something positive, he seems to be totally caught up in the fact that we have to maintain the American way of life or whatever it is we have to maintain.
When you return to America, is there any action you can take? Is there a peace group, an anti-war group?
Well, actually, it's very interesting because I think in the United States, those of us who are pacifists have become more and more involved in ecological kinds of things. And the fact that we feel that it's really the earth as a whole that we have to try and consider. And war is just so outrageous at this stage in the game that it's not anything to even consider. And I think that those of you in Europe who have lived through a war understand that in a way that many Americans don't. That I find also the thing that you mentioned this morning, that when you work with people who have been in war, when soldiers come back from Vietnam, they know what war is. And they know that it's hell. And there's no problem about that with them. It's the Americans who have always lived in luxury and who are used to being able to drive their car anywhere they want, anytime they want, that are the ones that are the hard ones, nuts to crack. It's just a shell around them that's really hard to get through. And Wolf and I both feel that we need to get out of the United States periodically because it's like living in a cocoon where all of the media and everything is just feeding in on itself. And to break through that, you just almost have to get out of that trap. It's just a real trap.
Well, Mary, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your experiences in World War II, the aftermath. It's been very interesting.
Well, thank you for asking me, even at this late hour of the night.
I was going to say, what is
gracious.
It, midnight? The hour struck.
Terrible.